I was going to ask you about the order of worship. Could you, what was his position on that?
You know, I didn't find anything that Sommer wrote about the order of worship. But his association with Alfred Elmore, of course, Alfred Elmore was an advocate of the set order, Acts 2:42, and so was W.J. Rice. And you might assume they learned that in one of those Bible readings, maybe. Or at least it would have been taught in any Bible reading that they held. So that seems to have been something that grew up in the same group, in the same part of the movement. I don't know much else to say about it, though.
You know, the strange thing about that was they believed that, but they didn't practice it all.
Yeah.
You know, they would state Acts 2:42 as a set order, then they'd go out and worship all over the country, wouldn't they?
Inconsistent conservatism. That was really what killed that brotherhood. The Mutual Edification Brotherhood hardly exists at all today because of that. And consequently, it's going to kill the digressive churches at large. They are dying as far as their identity is concerned. They may be growing in numbers in some ways, but the ones that are growing are the ones that are giving up all of their historic beliefs over opposition to instrumental music and their beliefs on baptism, because you cannot walk that balancing act. Or as the old timers used to say, if you leave the barn door open, all the cows can get out eventually. Seems to have, based on that Bible reading.
Very interesting. What relationship, if any, did Brother Phillips have with them, J.D. Phillips?
Well, you know, Brother Phillips, I have his paper, The Truth, and I read it ever so often. I've got a complete set, as far as I know, maybe missing a few volumes. And I don't really ever find him say anything about Daniel Sommer. I don't recall ever reading him mention Daniel Sommer much. You know, a lot of the folks in the Sommer group were rabid opponents of premillennialism. But when Sommer died, the fellow who, he published a songbook, and he was the editor of Word and Work with R.H. Bowell, but I can't recall what his name was at the time. He wrote an obituary of Sommer. He was, of course, a premillennialist and a proponent of premillennialism in the Churches of Christ. And he said in the obituary, Sommer agreed with me on prophecy to the very period. So that's interesting. What was that? Yes, it was Elmer Jorgensen. But the problem I have with that is, if you read Sommer's debate with William Miller, he believed the kingdom was established on the day of Pentecost. So he didn't agree with R.H. Bowell. He didn't agree with those premillennialists on that issue anyway.
Doug was influenced by Bowell Creighton, but on the order of worship, he actually went back to Campbell on that.
Right.
And then Alfred Elmore, very close to Alfred Elmore. But Doug was like, unfortunately, Doug was like a lot of these guys. He believed it, but he didn't always practice it. I mean, it was something they proposed, and they believed that that's the way it ought to be. Of course, Doug's out was this. He believed the cleansing of the sanctuary would come in 1972, and after that, everybody would do what was right. They'd go back to the ancient order. And so he could tolerate things up to 1972 that otherwise he wouldn't tolerate, because sanctuary hadn't been cleansed, and that's how he got out of it.
That's an interesting position. Obviously, nobody believes that now. But a lot of people believed it. A lot of people believed it. There was a book written called The Cleansing of the Sanctuary, and it was written by the fellow J.W. Kism from here in the state of Texas, who participated in that famous debate over spiritualism. And he takes that position. Robert Milligan believed that. He teaches it in the latter chapters of The Scheme of Redemption. And I think that that's really, it had a terrible effect on the Restoration movement. Some of those old restorers tried to play the prophet and set dates for significant events. And when it didn't happen, they got disappointed and discouraged, and they gave up on the valuable plea that they had previously professed.
Just a comment about that, Clint. This is really not about Daniel Sommer, but about premillennialism, or the millennium anyway. You know, they were, you mentioned this, most all of the restorers were post-millennialist. Most all of them were post-millennialist till about 1841. And between 1841, late 1841 and 1844, a good number of them were premillennialist because they expected the great day of, well, they call it the great day of disaster now, because William Miller said Jesus Christ was coming, and he didn't. And he said it again, and he didn't. But there's a three-year period there where a number of the restorers changed their views. And then most of them went back to post-millennialism, but it really lost drive and interest. In the 1820s, they thought they could see the millennium coming. That's why Campbell changed the name of his paper to the Millennial Harbinger. But then, after the William Miller disaster, they went back to post-millennialism, but they weren't as exuberant about it because it wasn't coming as rapidly as they wanted it to, and gradually they lost interest in that view altogether.
And I think that's when the movement started growing in two directions, where some continued to focus on restoration and others started focusing just on unity. If I have just a moment, I want to say something about those Bible readings, because it impressed me. In these Bible readings, a preacher would come to town, say it was A.M. Morris, and for 6 weeks, 12 weeks, 15 weeks, maybe even longer than that, the folks in the community, and some people would travel from a long way off and commit themselves to the whole reading, they would gather throughout the day, start in the morning and go to the afternoon and occasionally in the evening, and they would read through the Bible. But more than that, they would answer questions and go over how to interpret the Bible in its historical and prophetic context. And can you imagine? You know, there was a time when this study was 2 weeks long. Now it isn't even a week long. Can you imagine Christians taking time out of their lives to go to an 18-month Bible study? Yeah, they lost money, I'm sure. They lost work, but they were interested in learning the Bible. And in those days, of course, the churches of Christ were famous for the fact that our membership was very educated on the Bible. Now, the way those old Bible readings were held, we wouldn't approve of that because they let women speak. It was basically like a Sunday school. They didn't consider it an assembly of the church, but it was a public gathering in the church building where people gave sermons, and occasionally some women did. I want to read you this little excerpt from the Missouri Mission Messenger. He says, for the last day of January at our Bible reading, it is planned that the teacher will have 5 girls selected from the class and also 5 young men. They'll be asked Bible questions in order and thus let the congregation have the benefit of hearing the recitation. Of course, we wouldn't agree with that kind of a practice. But it's an interesting thing from history not too long ago.
I think in reference to John, if I'm not mistaken, I could be forgetting, but I believe Daniel Sommer wrote a tract on the order of worship and opposed it. I don't think I'm misremembering that. I have read that here in the recent past. The other thing I was going to mention on Daniel Sommer, talk about just a moment, if you will, about his position on women and their use in the assembly. Have you read much on that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Of course, as I just stated about women being allowed to speak at the Bible readings, Daniel Sommer, and it's important to know this history. It doesn't impact what the Bible says, but it's important to at least be aware of it. A lot of the restorers had much looser views on the role of women than we do. A.S. Hayden wrote a book on the role of women where he fully espoused a woman's right to be a preacher, which shocked me to read it from a man from that long ago. Sommer and his people basically held the view that a woman shouldn't preach in the Lord's Day assembly, but she could do other things. She could give an exhortation. Now, what's the difference between preaching a sermon and giving an exhortation? I've never heard an exhortation, I guess, but she could do that, and that was fine. And I remember reading one man from the Samarite group who said he believed a woman could preach, but not if her husband was in the room, and she shouldn't make a habit out of it. Inconsistent conservatism. And, of course, it's an untenable position.
Clint, do you want to touch on their somnorism and catcherside-ism on the law and grace and fellowship? Because that, I don't know of anything that ravaged the brotherhood in my generation and in the Church of Christ, not in our fellowship, but we can name a number, and we believe we've seen the same doctrine that's tore up some things in the Metroplex.
Well, I'll at least acknowledge the fact that my talk is a springboard into Richard's talk on Carl Ketcherside. And in Richard's talk, I'm sure he'll cover that issue a lot more than I would. Now, what's interesting, and I mentioned this at the end, is that Sommer basically went that direction himself toward the end of his life. He lived there in Indianapolis. He became a close friend of the president of Butler University. And Butler University was very liberal, and I mean in the truest sense of the term. They had faculty members who didn't believe in the inspiration of the Bible and didn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus, but he would come and be involved in lectureships and things like that at Butler and speak there. And by the time Sommer died, of course he was 90, and his son, D.A., said he went feeble. His mind went feeble in his old years and compared it to what happened to Alexander Campbell. But, of course, D.A. wasn't a big fan of Daniel Sommer, so it's hard to know how correct that assessment was. I think that some of the positions Sommer held, and I keep stressing inconsistent conservatism, that's where I would lay the main charge. And I think some of the positions he held, and especially some of the attitudes he had, his mean-spiritedness toward people, sent him down a road that led him to ultimate liberalism. And the same was true of Carl Ketcherside, but I want to infringe on Richard's talk there.